You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land and slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation, at least we hope it will be. As you know, from time to time, we travel down some dark side streets to investigate and explore grim subcultures that help make up the amalgam that is modern life. Tonight, a journey into the heart of darkness, the ultimate secret society, a close-knit organization that, at one time or another, has had its icy fingers dipped into every aspect of modern America, in business, politics, entertainment, everything from naughty and forbidden pleasures to extreme violence and outright corruption. This particular secret society has morphed into something else these days, melded, blended. In some ways, it's disappeared, but it's still out there in one form or another. If you think you know about the mafia, the mob, organized crime, because you've read The Godfather or you watched Casino, Goodfellas, Donnie Brasco, chances are you've got some bad information. And both of my guests tonight are here to help sort things out and tell us why this is still important. Bill Friedman knows the subject inside and out, and from many vantage points, he literally wrote the book on how to manage a modern Las Vegas casino and was one of the most successful operators on the Strip that this town's ever known. Because of his position during the heyday of the wise guys, he was able to gain some of their confidence and listen to stories that they wouldn't even tell their own families or their fellow gangsters. And he's perhaps the only person in history who had the odd assignment of hanging out with hoodlums as an alternative to military service. It's a very strange tale, but it worked out well for us because his research project, more than 40 years in the making, is now being unveiled, and it's a gargantuan undertaking, full of surprises involving names that we all know from reading newspapers or history books. Bill Friedman will join me in just a few minutes to share information, some of it never before made public, about some of the founding members of organized crime and how their operations changed our country forever. Then in the second half of the program, another inside view of organized crime from someone who worked with the new face of the mob. Writer Toby Rogers, grew up with one of the new kingpins of organized crime, a guy descended from mafia royalty and modern in every way, but it's a world where some of the most vicious of the old traditions continue. It's a look inside the drug underworld of New York and the story of the ganja godfather. No matter where you live, something like this is unfolding in your backyard. Toby Rogers joins me in the second half of the program tonight. The world certainly is rumbling today, isn't it? An enormously powerful earthquake rocked Nepal, and folks there are still reeling from the impact. Volcanic eruptions in Chile, just burying parts of that country in volcanic ash. A story broke today that Russian hackers managed to bust into President Obama's email. You think your email's secure? Webmaster Tim Binal and I put together some news items and oddities that we've culled from various media outlets and online sources. We posted on the Coast website under Knapp's News. Among the stories in this current incarnation are a true life mystery about a very unusual disappearance that may or may not involve foul play. It's just flat out weird. And there's some video of the woman whose death remains unexplained. Might be a good show for us sometime here on Coast to Coast down in the future. Alyssa Lamb is the lady's name. Terrific piece also about UFO intrusions over the nuclear weapons storage area at Nellis Air Force Base. Security officers now saying they not only saw strange craft hovering over the nukes, but they saw beings, humanoid beings. That site, by the way, less than 5 miles from where I am at the moment. A good report from Robert Hastings. I think you'll enjoy it. So what happens when your iPhone becomes smarter than you by a factor of maybe 100? If that doesn't bother you, I don't think you're paying attention. We've got a story posted. And dealing with the aftermath of the carnage in the Gulf of Mexico, will it ever be the same, especially for those who make their living from the ocean. That and a lot more on NAPS News tonight, plus a story on the website about the mysterious X-37B getting ready to head back into space. They still won't tell us what this plane's mission is. Check it out while you're on the Coast webpage. Take a look at the information on how to become a Coast Insider. Allows you to access a vast library of programs, previous interviews. You can listen as often as you want, anytime, any place you want. It's a great deal for pennies a day. Time now for our first break, and when we return, a walk on the dark side. Bill Friedman spoke face to face with some of the best known names in the underworld and will be here to tell us about it. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Bill Friedman was my guest once before on this program. He, as you might remember, is the president of Friedman Management Group, which solves casino marketing problems. He's a casino consultant all through the U.S., in England, South Africa, Monaco, Australia, Russia, Canada, the Caribbean. Cool job to have. It goes all over the world to consult with other casinos, and he's not only sort of talked the talk, he's walked the walk. He managed two Las Vegas Strip casinos at the same time. The only person in history to do that. He's taught casino management, and because he was in that position, he got to know a lot of the characters that we're going to talk about tonight. Bill, it's great to have you back on the program.
It's good to be here.
Man, this is a massive undertaking. This new book is called 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. And let's start this way. Why does the world need another book about mobsters?
I became fascinated as a young man with the I became a dealer in Nevada, and I became fascinated with the men who worked behind me because they'd all come out of illegal gambling. Nevada didn't have a homegrown industry, so every time a new hotel opened anywhere in the state or a casino made a major expansion, they'd bring in illegal executives and dealers, or bring in executives and dealers from illegal casinos. And they'd lived such a different lifestyle from anything I'd been exposed to, I became fascinated with them. And so I started reading about them, and there were a number of books written about early organized crime and about Nevada, and I assumed it was all true. But as I talked to people, I found out that all of this was basically fiction. And I set out on a long journey that's now not quite a half century, in which I've read 150,000 old newspapers, 200,000 pages of FBI reports, and interviewed all the key people, including the underworld figures that built the Nevada casinos for the first 40 years. And I found that what these authors had done is they would read like 16 headlines, and from that write complete and total fiction, to the point that in the my book, I show that for two people, gangster Joe Adonis and gangster Arnold Rothstein, that both of them had been involved as victims of terrible scams. And it was a one-time deal, and yet in almost all these books, they're not mentioned as the victim. The people who wrote it didn't even read the articles that they were the victim one time, and they're both usually listed as this was their crime specialty, which it never was. And it just runs through it all, and for the first time, I've been able to put the whole story together and show not only what actually happened, but in the appropriate places show how each book just absolutely does not correspond to the facts that are available at all.
So a lot of what we consider organized crime or know about the mob is just complete baloney.
Exactly.
You knew at an early age you were hooked right off the bat by casinos. I mean, I think you said in the book at age 7 your parents took you and you saw gambling in action, and you knew right then that's what you wanted to do.
Yes, and they took me, we lived in Oakland, California, and they took me up for a week's vacation at Lake Tahoe when I was 7, and they had one casino there, and I was fascinated with the way the blackjack dealers dealt, and the laws weren't as tough at that time, and I tried to watch, and they said, you're going to have to stand back a few feet, and I spent every afternoon watching, And I went home, and every boy I knew either wanted to be a fireman or a cop, and I was telling everyone I want to be a Las Vegas dealer.
And you, your first job, I mean, as soon as you're old enough, you got a job in a casino as a shill. Tell what a shill does. I think people not here in Nevada won't believe that such a job exists.
Yeah, we, the Fremont Hotel downtown in Las Vegas, had a lot of high-rolling play, and they had 40 shills on swing shifts. So during the height of the dinner hour, during the height of the shows, when the tables would tend to empty out, players want to be where the action is. So they had employed all of us, and we would be sent in to act like customers, and they'd keep track of how much we won or lost. When we left the table, we balanced out. And that was our job, just to sit there and let the money go back and forth. We had no involvement with it, and just make the place look busy to anyone walking through it.
Then you became a dealer, and you were dealing at the same time you were going to college.
Yes, I was very lucky because I wanted to deal, and I was going to college at San Francisco State, and the next summer, I became a dealer at what was then the largest casino in the world, the new Sahara Tahoe, and I worked the whole summer there, and they were so busy that the first 90 days, I never got a day off. I'd go home, and some nights they'd make me work a double, and so I had 8 hours off before the next shift, and I got to the point where I got no break because I was actually dreaming of dealing cards the whole night after work. But then during the winter, they didn't need me as much. So I went to college on Tuesdays and Thursdays in San Francisco and dealt Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday at Lake Tahoe. So they saved a day's pay when they didn't need me. And I had the job that I most dreamed about.
You get an assignment, and this is amazing, but you get an assignment basically from the government that you're supposed to hang out with hoodlums, which is how it's sort of the beginning of a 48-year-long research project that culminates with this book. Tell me the story.
Well, when I got into the business and I had all these executives behind me that had worked in illegal gambling, most of them had at best a grammar school education, but they had incredible street smarts. They had incredible perception. They were like nobody ever knew. They paid police for their illegal casino operations, what they called protection. But I just sat and listened to what they had to say. And I realized they may have called it protection, but it wasn't. They paid the police not to harass them, but they got no help or protection from the police. They had an illegal business. If they called 911, the police would not have shown up. So they had to protect themselves from the gambling cheats, which were very, very prevalent in that period. And they had to protect their bankroll from robbery, from gangs trying to take over their territory. And these were the most independent, toughest guys I ever met, but they were different than we think of most of organized crime. All of organized crime wants to get your money, but these guys were gamblers, and gamblers are different than the other people in organized crime. They too want your money, but they don't want to physically harm you. So these were basically good men who were in an illegal business, and I was so fascinated, every night after work, I tried to get one of the guys to go have a nightcap, and I'd just sit like a kid at his father's knees listening to their stories. My dream was to do the research, but of course, working full-time, I couldn't do that. And the Vietnam War came along. I was one of the first people drafted. I declared as a conscientious objector, and under the law, the Selective Service system had to have the FBI investigate whether I deserved that designation. And after they'd completed it, I was sat down and they explained to me that for your 2 years of alternate service, because they don't want you to benefit from this designation, the normal procedure is to pick a hospital near your home and for 2 years you clean bedpans. But they said, in your case, you have accomplished something that no one else ever has. You come from a completely lily-white background, and yet you hang out and belong in the world of gangsters. And they were particularly impressed because this was years before the FBI ever inserted an undercover agent into a gang. They said, you love gambling. You have a background in social psychology. You can, for the first time, put together how organized crime developed and how it operates. So they gave me the choice of either cleaning bedpans or hanging out with hoodlums in Vegas for 2 years. And after making this very tough decision, I picked the hoodlums. So I got my draft notice, and all of this is on my website, and all the documents, because this is so unusual. And they ordered me to go to work for the School of Criminology at the University of California, Berkeley, for 2 years. And it was headed by a very fine criminologist. He designed the program. I didn't ask anyone any questions that were under 10 years old, so that it was clear this was not a sting, that I was purely going after history. And they ordered me to go to Vegas for 2 years. And when I wasn't interviewing people, I was in the library reading the documents, because my interviews, just like you as an investigative reporter, were very detailed. I never asked them, tell me a good story. I sat down and I had their background as far as I could find any record of it, and just went through their whole lives and the operations they were involved in.
Did you tell these guys, the so-called hoodlums, I'm using air quotes, did you tell them what you were doing? Hey, I'm going to ask you some questions. I'm working on a research project. And some of this is going to end up with the feds, or did you have to kind of be fuzzy about that?
No, I told them the truth on absolutely everything except that I was ordered to do it. And remember, this was going to the university, not to them directly. What they were interested in was the conclusions, was how does this actually work?
It's interesting to me, for people outside of Nevada and outside the gambling industry, that when casino operations were legalized here, I mean, this is a fledgling industry. The only people who had any experience at all in operating casinos were illegal gamblers. So Nevada needed those guys to help get the industry going. You make the point in your book that in particular, there were reasons why you needed somebody experienced to keep it on the up and up.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I interviewed everybody that made contributions to the development of the industry. So, of course, we're talking about the hoodlums tonight, but I talked to the gaming control people, which this was the only state that had it at that time, and law enforcement and the politicians, so, and the bankers, etc. And the first two heads of the gaming control board told me in detail what I'm going to tell you, but they said at the time, do not publish this particular information now because the state will look bad. This has to come later, but we want you to have the truth. And in the early years, cheating was so prevalent, and just to emphasize the point, if we were in a dealer's room on the Strip or at Lake Tahoe or in Reno, I guarantee you that you almost couldn't get through a break without hearing about a new scam pulled somewhere. I mean, it was just unbelievable the number of people that could deal any card off the deck or switch the dice, etc. Marking cards was very prevalent. And so for that reason, anyone who, when people would apply for a license, the state maintained, we want the most honest, clean people possible. But the truth was, in the early years, if a legitimate businessman came in and he did not have a top gambling figure running it for him who knew cheating inside out, and that was the main criteria of being a good casino manager at that time, they tried to block the licenses of these legitimate people, and they tried to take what they called the good hoods versus the bad hoods. And both of them had the same definition. If they'd been involved in prohibition and they'd been involved in illegal gambling, they were okay. If they'd been involved in any of the other crimes which involved any type of pressure on people, any type of exploitation, they didn't want them. And actually, they did a remarkable job. The people that ended
Bill, I'm going to interrupt you here. We'll pick up this conversation on the other side. Bill Friedman is my guest, talking about the evolution of the mob, how it ended up in Las Vegas. And we'll get more of that conversation right after Steely Dan takes us into the break. From 1980, Judas Priest, Breaking the Law. That's sort of what we're talking about tonight, where Bill Friedman is just trying to explain to us how Nevada regulators had to make the decision who's a good hood and who's a bad hood, what criteria they would use to decide that. And in his new book, he details how some of the most notorious figures from organized crime may have gotten a bad rap. We're going to get into that and some of the people he talked to face-to-face right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Friedman, before the break, you were telling us how those Nevada regulators had to make the tough decision. They wanted people who were experienced with casinos. That meant they had to let people in who'd done illegal stuff, but they didn't want people to come in who were notorious killers, murderers, rapists, the bad hoods. I would think that the lines would be blurred at times.
Well, they had a hard time getting the information. Their lines were... illegal gambling was fine. Prohibition, liquor violations were fine. Anything involving any type of violence, threats, exploitation, in other words, practically every other crime that organized crime's in. What's interesting is that when they did the investigations, they would go to the local police, who would, of course, assist with the information they had, but they have a very limited information of what comes across their investigations and the charges, whereas they found the most important source of information came from the investigative reporters of that era, and the guys were extraordinary, and my book wouldn't be possible without all the investigations they did, but they got to know the local hoodlums, and they often communicated with them, and the hoods assisted the reporters. Partly they liked them, but partly they would trade bad information on their competing gangsters in return that they hoped they wouldn't be treated so badly when their name hit the papers. And they found that they gave them the deepest insight because they were literally talked to by the gangsters. And I went through all of the licensing for several decades, and everything they found and everything I could find, and with few exceptions, they did a good job. They kept out the real bad ones, and although a few ended up as hidden interests, they certainly couldn't have been licensed. And the rest of them, they were involved in those specific crimes, but that was it, and they made very good citizens.
The guys who became titans of Las Vegas and who are viewed, you know, even today by law enforcement, feds in particular, as pillars of organized crime, actually went straight when they came to Las Vegas. They had to. But that label always followed them. People like Mo Dalitz, who was, you know, he was an amazing guy. And I'm, you know, I tried for a long time to get interviews with him. I never did, but you did. He's a good example of that.
I did, but George, it's not quite the way you think. I just like to say that this great era of investigative reporters, you're one of the last people in the country left. It's not a failure on your part. You have no idea what I went through trying to get to him. I had gotten some of the really big people in the Las Vegas society, an attorney Cliff Jones, who worked for every hotel, where today they have corporate attorneys and they have attorneys working on site at the hotels. He did everybody's business and knew everybody's business. Another gangster, Benny Binion, took me in the fold. I asked each one of these guys, everyone was a friend of Mo, and I asked them, please tell him I'm okay, and he just said, I don't talk. Well, I went on for my first year trying to get to him, and I couldn't. And finally, someone gave me the direct line to his suite. And I called his suite one morning. I decided, you know, I made some judgment calls, and I thought, he ain't going to be in the office, the suite likely on weekdays, so it's got to be a weekend. I don't want to wake him up. So I called at 10:15 on a Sunday, and he answered. And he knew, of course, that I had gotten it surreptitiously. He was clearly unhappy, but very contained. And I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, absolutely not. I mean, he was emphatic. And he was about to hang out up, and I was desperate, knowing my one and only shot, and I didn't even plan this. Out of my mouth, I said, Mo, you have done very well here in Nevada, and don't you think you owe it to the people to tell your story? And that caught him. And he said, be in my office tomorrow at 8 a.m. Now can I go back to the football game? And so the next morning I show up at 8 o'clock at his office at the Stardust, and it was actually a lobby office. There was a receptionist there and a couple other desks. There's three businessmen lined up looking at the wall almost in front of them, and the receptionist. And there's another man standing there, and I didn't know what Mo looked like. And I walked in at 8 o'clock, and I said why I was there, and I sat down. And this guy standing there just stared at me and stared at me. And he finally blurted with the most intense, he didn't swear, he didn't stutter, but he came at me with the most intense temper I have ever encountered. And he said, I know you're a good kid, but what you're trying to do is going to put me in jail. He said, I want you to stop your research. I want you to leave town. You're done with this. And I knew I was in real trouble if I opened my mouth, so I just sat there. The three men that were sitting there had all been looking straight ahead. They didn't move. They were like frozen. The secretary had her arm in the air with a pen. Her arm froze about 8 inches off the desk after the pen dropped. Nobody moved. I've never seen anything like it. The intensity was there, but it wasn't that craziness you can see in people. And he said, you go back to your apartment, and I'm going to send somebody there to work this out. Well, it was 8 o'clock I started. 8:15, I'm on my way back to my apartment. I get there at 8:30, and a friend I'd met in college was staying on my couch, and I walked in, and I told him what had happened, and I said, you know, in my whole life, I've never heard of a businessman saying, go to your apartment, and I'm going to send someone over to negotiate. I said, I think I'm a dead man. And as he packed, he said, I think so too. So he was out of the apartment in 3 minutes. He's still a very dear friend a half century later. And I sat there waiting the whole day for someone to show up. And it was such a shocking experience. I didn't work that day. I just sat on my couch, and the whole time, not knowing what was going to happen, all I heard was Peggy Lee singing, Is This All There Is? I thought that was the end. Well, when no one showed up, I went on with my life, and a few days later, the key executive at the Stardust called me up. He had been the chief of police in Las Vegas, and he said, be at my office such and such a time, and we had a long talk, and he said they were checking me out, and I told him about the temper that Mo had. I said, I've never seen anything like it, and he said, oh, you haven't seen him at his worst. And I said, you couldn't prove that by me. So he arranged an interview that in the restaurant that went on 2 hours, and it went beautifully. And this is why I'm saying it had nothing to do with you not getting to him. I'm the first and only person he talked to. The second interview, during the 2 hours, he kept getting more and more agitated and itchy and moving, and I kept wondering, what am I asking him? Because this was basic stuff about his operations and background. And finally he said, I can't do this. I cannot talk. He said, this is it. He said, I'm going to send you to a businessman who knows everything about me, and you can question him. And I didn't understand it at the time, but I came in with a clear goal, but with total naivety of the people I was dealing with. In that era, nobody told anything to anybody if they came out of Prohibition, because they would go out to sea to pick up in high-speed boats from oceanic freighters, huge cargoes. They didn't want people knowing when they were leaving in the middle of the night. They didn't want to slip and indicate the time they were going out to sea, when their convoys would be moving, when they'd be going to their storage for facilities for delivery, and they didn't tell anyone anything, to the point that they didn't tell their closest associates anything they were doing, that they weren't a participant with the other person. And several times when I was in people's offices or their homes and I was interviewing them, and I had all this information, I'd already talked to their old partner, I had documents, and I'd say, by the way, they were in this or that business, or they did this, and they'd start yelling and screaming at me because they never heard it. I thought at times they were about to throw me out. Nobody talked, and that's why you couldn't get to him. He wasn't about to talk to anybody, and I thought that I was just being passed off. He said, I'll give you to this businessman, and he said, I'll tell all my executives they can tell you anything they want, and if there's any consequences, they won't be held responsible. And I thought, this is a joke, but I didn't know that this man had integrity beyond belief, which would be proven to me. So he sends me to a businessman, and the businessman starts answering all my questions. Well, he and I developed a father-son relationship to the point that many years later, decades later, I was an executor for his estate to handle it for his family. We were very, very close. And this went on for years. But at about the 10-year mark, I was finally trusted. And I quote this man many times in my book. And said to me, you know, you think we became friends because I liked you. He said, didn't work like that. I was a busy man. I didn't need you in my life. He said, Mo was afraid of you. And he said, I was told to keep you under surveillance to make sure you weren't getting to anything we didn't want you to have. He said, think about every interview you had with me. He said, I told you all kinds of stuff. I helped you get to the other executives. But at the end, I always asked you, like in a fatherly way, how you were doing, what you were up to, what you were learning, and we were waiting to see if you were going to become a threat. Then he laid the bombshell on me. He was Mo's chief enforcer.
This is a name I had never heard before.
Professional killer. What?
I'd never heard this name before your book. I didn't know this name.
What happened was, this man had been a SEAL in the Second World War, moved to Nevada right after, became the he directed the yacht for Ben Siegel on Lake Mead, 30 miles outside of Las Vegas, and Mo visited regularly because he liked to go mountain lion hunting. They were close friends. He got to know Mo, and when Mo came to Vegas, he moved in as his chief enforcer. And when the Stardust opened up in 1958, Mo came to him and he said, "We have one weak link in this organization." He said, "You're living on the most expensive golf course in town. You don't work. Eventually, someone's going to figure out that you are getting your income illicitly, and you're going to be the link they go after. You have to have a job." He said, "Well, what job should I have?" He says, "The Stardust will be the biggest hotel in the world, and every fine hotel has a convention salesman." He said, "You're going to become a convention salesman." So Mark said to him, "Well, what's that?" He says, "I don't know, but they all have them." He says, "Well, what am I supposed to do?" And this is an aside, Mo Dalitz was the most incredible networker I've ever heard of. There was no businessman, no politician in the world this man didn't get to, and the stories will be in future books when the strip develops. And he could reach out to anyone, so he sent Mark to the finest hotels in America for 3 days each, and the convention salesman spent the whole time teaching him the business. He came back, and he was the official convention salesman, but every time Mo was in trouble, Mark was the man, to the point when he would tell me really personal stuff about Mo. I said, by this time, we were very close. I said, "How did you know this?" He said, "Bill, when Mo went to the mattresses, I'm the man who protected him." He said, "We lived together alone, surrounded by a bunch of guys with shotguns and 20 hunting dogs that sounded if anybody came into the area." And he said, "Mo and I had nothing to do but talk to each other. I know everything about him. He was telling you the truth." To finish the story, this was in 1968 that Mo first talked to me, the two interviews. In 1978, a full decade later, I hadn't seen Mo for years. I'm at my office at the Castaways. The secretary calls up, his secretary from the Stardust, and she says, "So-and-so's in town. He's visiting for the first time in a long time. Mo was thinking about it." This is a decade later. "Mo was thinking about it, and he doesn't think you got to talk to him. Did you?" And I said, "No." She said, "Would you like to?" I said, "Yes." She said, "I'll set up the appointment for tomorrow." So I ended up working all day at the Castaways and Flipper. That night I stayed up the whole night because I had to go back through all my notes and questions and put it together. It became a very important interview. But a decade later, when he had said, "I'll see you can get to everybody," it was bothering him that there was one thing he hadn't accomplished.
Wow. You know, you use the term in the book that Mo Dalitz was the closest thing Las Vegas had to a godfather. We're going to go to a break in about 2 minutes, but maybe you could sort of summarize his stature in Las Vegas, what he did, and why he's such a major figure.
Mo was absolutely respected by everybody. This integrity, this strength of his, he knew everybody in the underworld. I meant intimately. He knew everybody that was powerful in the society and the business. And so if people had problems, they went to him. And when he could, he helped them. He was just an incredible figure. The newspapers printed him up as this dangerous gangster. And, of course, except to defend himself, he was never violent in his whole life. And everybody trusted him. And everybody knew that when the chips were down, Mo would be backing you up.
You said that we mentioned this first name, but didn't mention the last name, Swain. Mark Swain is the guy
Mark
you're talking
Swain.
About.
Yes, he was the man. He was the convention a salesman at the Stardust when it was a tough sale because Vegas had an image that it was nothing but gambling, showgirls, and prostitutes. and to try to get businesses to come here for their conventions when the men would be leaving their wives was an unbelievably tough sale. There was three super convention salesmen. I knew all of them really well, and they all fought this battle real hard back then.
We're going to take another break. The chairman of the board, another old blue eyes, takes us into the break with a classic Vegas vibe, Luck Be a Lady. We'll continue our conversation with Bill Friedman and find out if anyone asked him to do anything illegal right after this on Coast to Coast AM.